Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today I welcome contemporary figurative artist and painter Susanna Coffey as my guest. She's the University of Tulsa School of Art's Ruth Mayo Distinguished Visiting Artist. And a new mini retrospective of her work will be exhibited at the Alexander Hogue Gallery beginning tomorrow. Coffey is the Sellers Professor in Painting at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. Her work is part of the collections of the Art Institute, Yale University Art Gallery, the National Academy Museum, the Boston Museum of Fine Arts, among others. She's best known for her self-portraits, a subject she has focused on for over 30 years. They featured backdrops of increasing complexity, and in her most recent work, the backdrops nearly completely sublimates the foreground painting. Also on display is a selection of her night paintings. The exhibit Going to Ground opens tomorrow at the Hogue Gallery with a lecture by the artist at 4 o'clock, the gallery opening at 5 o'clock in Phillips Hall on the TU campus. Susanna Coffey is my guest today. Susanna Coffey, welcome to Studio Tulsa and welcome to Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me to speak with you today. Every day in my studio, I listen, as do most studio artists, to public radio, so thrilled to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you, and congratulations on being the Ruth Mayo Distinguished Visiting Artist. Your show, Going to Ground, this features really a lot of work going back over a lot of your history as a painter. What were you trying to accomplish with this particular show?
I was putting groups of paintings together so that I could look at and or show others some of the meanings that interest me and that I wish others to apprehend. So I chose work that was particularly involved with this idea of a human figure in a painted area in the painting that was not the figure. That is a landscape, areas of beautiful paint. In the painting of my father, there's some text and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So I've chosen works that are, as the title of the show says, going to ground, and that is that a person is most accurately portrayed when their surroundings are taken into account.
Now, when I saw that title, I was thinking of some of the paintings, more recent paintings actually, your self-portraits, which this has been a big part of your work. Really, the portrait is being subsumed by the backdrop.
Yes.
And there's one that has, it's a green painting where it's a very lush, looks like a grass or jungly look, and it's almost subsuming the figure, the self-portrait. I thought that was maybe where you were going with it. Has this been a new development in your self-portraits?
Well, my choice of portraiture as a genre has to do with my feelings about people, as mm-hmm. well as my feelings about art. So the idea, again, that a person is sometimes very much the focus, could be a friend, could be a family member, us right now facing each other, you are very much in my focus. But there are times, many times, and probably most of our days and nights or when we are with others, where the environment overcomes the experience of the individual. And I felt that in portraiture, I wanted to go at that in some way, express that.
How did you begin doing self-portraiture? Of course, there's a long history of it ever since artists developed mirrors.
No.
And we always think of the self-portrait as sort of a window of insight into the artist. Is there a sense of self-expression and self-discovery as you're doing these self-portraits, especially since you've been doing them for 30 years or more?
It started when I began my commitment to painting figuratively. And that happened in a way in my early years when I had a bad attitude towards most portraits. And I'm ashamed of that now. You know, there are many great artists that I understand are amazing. But I felt there was a lack, particularly in the history of European portraiture. There were ways that people were imaged that seemed to me either unrealistic or that there was a lot missing. So that, in my student years, helped me to be, I was angry and resentful, as are many young artists. It's the way we keep going. with the history of figurative painting. I have a different attitude today, but I was committed to painting figuratively and really the history of painting as well, because I felt like that story wasn't over either. So the focus on self-portraits came much later, and it really just came about in a backdoor way. After graduate school, I was fortunate to get a job at the Art Institute of Chicago, where I am still teaching mm-hmm. today. And I got a job teaching figure painting. But I was painting figures. However, they were figures from my imagination. And here I was responsible for these young artists, and I needed to teach them something. Having come up in the 70s when people didn't teach painting.
And they certainly didn't teach portraiture, or they didn't teach realistic.
Painting from observation.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh my God, I had really better learn something here so that I can teach it. I began in my home studio just doing the side project of painting from observation in order to really understand what the history was and to learn how other artists had started from the ground up. So I couldn't afford a model at my huge entry salary, and I painted myself, not thinking that this would be anything other than make work and learning. It was an exercise. So I did this for many years, and I had this other small career in Chicago making 1980s slash and burn expressionist paintings of mythological figures.
Right.
So as I continued to paint the self-portraits, one day I really saw that I had learned something, and the image of the painting in front of me offered the possibility to hold the expressions about the figure, about the female figure, about interiority, about how one person is really not a singular entity, but is comprised of many experiences and overlaps with others, both living and dead. And I saw that this tiny self-portrait painting in series could actually more clearly and understandably, more directly express what got me beginning to paint in the figure.
I'm going to go back to that. You said you're talking about the 1970s. The decision to go figurative, that was probably, now you were at Yale. I assume this is Albers and you know, we're painting the square over and over and over again. Minimalist, you know, this is what was going on. Maybe some photorealism somewhere else in New York and the like. But that was about the only figurative painting that was going on at that. I mean, when I think about it, you know, there was either Pop, the last vestige of Pop, which is a very stylized realism, or photorealism, but nobody doing really figurative work. What made you go to that direction?
It started in undergraduate school, and it really started with my class and an exhibition by Tamara Northern, who's is an art historian who works in the history of West African sculpture. And in taking that class and looking at this exhibition at the University of Connecticut that she had created on Cameroon masks and objects, I looked at these and I thought, this work is figurative, and yet the meanings it's addressing are so wide and so clear that a figurative image, a human image, can stand for our ability to be social creatures, our ability to have psychology, our ability to have spiritual resonance, our ability to be transgressive. They seem to allow an expression of the wide spectrum of human behavior. And I thought, oh, figuration. I tried sculpture, and I'm like the worst sculptor in the world. It really was not my vocation, let's say. So that in the classes where I bought some paint and got some brushes, I thought, well, that's what I'll try. I'll try to go here. And I was a really terrible artist, and pursuing figuration made me one of the most uncool students in the school. I couldn't have chosen a less hip thing to do. but I was very excited, and I had a deep commitment to this direction. So when I got to graduate school, fortunately, even though the larger art world looked upon my interest as being jejune at best, why is she here? So I was lucky to have Lester Johnson on the faculty, and I was lucky to have Gretna Campbell on the faculty, and William Bailey was on the faculty, as well as Bernie Chait. So there were four faculty members whose work involved figuration. And while, as I later heard, it was understandable to everyone that I was not an outstanding student, I really felt there were people to teach me. And mm-hmm. that was really wonderful. I have so much gratitude. First for them, put it, one person, a visiting artist, as we would have very famous visiting artists,
yes, right,
all the time. And I think, I can't remember who it was. Maybe it was Eric Fischel, or I can't remember. Anyway, mm-hmm. It was someone of national stature that was very famous at the time. Went into my studio, looked around, saw about a couple square inches that William Bailey had painted on my painting, and said, "That's great. You should do that." So it wasn't a time of great.
Wow. I mean, how did you keep after it when you get something like that?
Well, I think we all, when a young person or anyone finds a way in which their deepest self is involved in learning and the most comprehensive aspect of ourselves is engaged in a task that seems like too much and impossible, but it's a big task. So mm-hmm. my task was to take this pool of meaning that I really believed needed to be imaged and bring it up to speed in regards to the canon. And that I wanted to really bear the weight of history. Like some artists who are important and wonderful like to throw off history, and those artists involved in the avant-garde. But I wanted to schlep, and I really felt like I had to really, in order for the meaning that interested me, that I deeply cared about, to come forward, I had to get the work up to speed with the history, which was substantial in
right.
several thousands of years.
Well, I think you have to go back about the turn of the last century to really think of an artist that was making portraiture, or even self or otherwise, in which you would consider it to be art for art's sake. I'm thinking of Sargent, but I'm sure there's a couple in the 20th century too, but I can't really think of them.
Alice Neal, I saw the most amazing.
Oh, yes, Alice Neal. That's right.
Carrie James Marshall now. And Beaufort Delaney, but not a lot.
Right,
yes,
right. Alice Neal in the 50s and 60s really was when she was really doing the portraits. I think
the most psychological painter of the 20th century.
Yeah.
I was skipping over to the 30th century somehow. Wishful thinking, I suppose.
Well, what I love about your self portraits, one is, it's almost like a stylized pose that you have. And as I was thinking about it, it's probably you're looking at yourself in the mirror from that angle. And that's where we get this sort of tilted, uplifted head figure. And it's really a bust almost in nearly all of your self-portraits. But what is interesting is when you look in the 1990s and 80s, there's very clear backdrops. And eventually the backdrops begin overtaking the bust.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right. And that's this show. So it's interesting that you thank you for noticing that, because it does have to do with the aspect that I wasn't able to get in the earlier work.
So take me back to that point where all of a sudden the backdrop became as interesting to you as the subject matter of a self-portrait.
It was always interesting to me. I was always cognizant of the relationship of figure to ground. And this is important in music, the relationship of silence to, you know, noise, to sound. So and in poetry, of course, line breaks and the spaces between words. In figurative painting, the relationship between the primary image and the secondary images. That's always something I was very involved with, but I was just doing as good as I could to get my primary signifier worked out with an elaboration. Mm-hmm. And the secondary signifier, which was the background, I would choose that to support and to skew the meaning of the primary signifier so that, let's say, in one painting, the space was deeper. So one would get a sense that in looking at that painting, you're with somebody that's close, but they are in a place that where far away is existing, that you can see where far away is. And other paintings have a very shallow space, so the sense, hopefully, is that one is with somebody that is right in your space. Mm-hmm. In the confrontational way. They're all symmetrical. So the pose and this idea of symmetry and the scale is really involved with my original inspiration, and that is the mask. Mm. The paintings are the size of a mask, and the symmetry, I'm like nuts about symmetry, where it's on, where it's off. It's like a little crazy. But they're all like that. So I spend many people get up in the morning and they look in the mirror and they go off to work. Well, I go off to work and I look in the mirror 8 hours, 10 hours a day.
My guest today is Susanna Coffey, the Ruth Mayo Distinguished Visiting Artist at the University of Tulsa. She teaches at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, a distinguished painter, and the TU School of Art is featuring a display. It's almost like a mini retrospective in many ways, Going to Ground. It opens tomorrow and will be on display through December 15th at the Alexander Ho Gallery with an opening lecture tomorrow at the School of Art at 4 o'clock. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, I wanted to ask about the symmetry because I was reading an interview in which, having not seen you work, they were watching you work, and it is literally you're going left, right, left, right, left, right to do your work. Mm-hmm. Is it that didactic? I mean,
yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yes, I'm measuring everything.
Uh huh.
And I learned this from Giacometti, and indeed, I saw it at work from somebody. A contemporary artist, Stanley Lewis, who I love. He's a valued colleague. And again, to stress how long my journey has been, I learned this from, I had hired him to teach in a summer program, and I watched him teach and watched him paint with the students, and I saw him do what one sees in a Giacometti portrait, that is those lines, and I saw what he was doing, just measuring. And once I got measuring, I realized that vision is not, there are different ways to see. And when one wants to understand what one is seeing and the relationship between all the aspects of one's field of vision, measurement is required. One has to measure like relative size, shape, relative darkness and lightness in order to actually see what's there in a ontological way. That seeing things as they are really asks of us all to bring more to bear than a casual gaze. Mm-hmm. And feeling is enhanced by understanding these relationships. I suppose it's same in music. You're a musician, so yeah. I'm sure there might be an idea that a jazz musician just goes up there and plays. Right.
No.
No, in short. One has to understand, take into account what's there at the moment, the intervals of sound and mm-hmm. proximity to the other musicians and so on and so forth. It's the same thing with vision, not to speak of painting, but my painting is really about how vision contains feeling state. And that's where all of that measuring, it is didactic. I spent hours and days, weeks, months, years finding the right measurements that then add up to an image that has a kind of feeling to it. And I guess I would, use the metaphor of music there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now I want to ask about some of the other, there's a lot of small pieces mm-hmm. in this show, and And a lot of them are these night paintings, which I guess you've been doing them for a while, but
yes.
What I've seen is just of the last few years. And what interested you in night paintings? I mean, some of them are so cool. There's a little gas station along the road in
Milton,
Pennsylvania.
Yeah,
I knew it was Pennsylvania. That's all I could remember.
Yes.
One of your father's house.
Yes.
And, of course, there's a portrait in the show of your father as well.
Yes.
One of the few that's not you.
Yes, I'll talk about that in a minute.
Your father's house, and I assume it's places you went. I know you did a show in Anchorage, and so you had an Anchorage sky piece. So how did you get started doing the night paintings?
Well, really, just like the paintings, it happened sort of backwards. It wasn't exactly intentional. I teach quite a bit, and for many years, I had a rather exhaustive life on the road, teaching and lecturing and so on and so forth. It's another subject, but I'm very interested in, you know, the young artist. But during those times, it was very difficult for me because I couldn't paint. I'd be teaching all day or working with people all day in various ways. So I didn't get, I couldn't be an artist while I was being a teacher. And that really, it's a very unhappy thing for me. So one day, I was in 1995, I was in my truck on the way to Vermont, to the Vermont Studio Center from New York, and I stopped in my favorite town, New Haven. Well, Tulsa might be there too. after tonight, we're going to paint outside tonight. So,
oh, cool.
So excited about that. I stopped at the Yale Museum, and I just wandered around. I thought, oh, just let me look at some paintings before I have to talk about them. And there was Millet's Starry Night in the collection. It's the painting that influenced Van Gogh, who was devoted to Millet's work. And I thought, night, duh, I can go out at night and paint after I'm teaching.
And I imagine the small size is something you can take with you.
Yes, I just put it in my hand, a knapsack with a few paintbrushes, a flashlight, and I gathered a couple students and went out that night in the mountains of Vermont and sat. I realized how amazing it is just to sit for maybe just an hour in darkness and let one's eyes adjust to the colors and the shapes and do something. Of course, you can't exactly see what you're doing.
And that probably adds to it at the same time.
Hello. You can't make a bad night painting. I shouldn't tell everyone that because that would be the end of that line of my exhibition career. You didn't hear that, people. You can only get them from me. Everyone, you can't make a bad night painting. And that, so I continued to do the practice. It was like discovering gold. It's so much fun. How many people, I had never really just gone outside and sat and looked at a landscape.
Now, when you're doing a lot of small things, do you say, I like this one a lot, let me make it bigger? Or do you never work that way?
No, I just do them and that's it.
Okay.
Because they're not, in a way, you know, it seems like leave well enough alone.
Okay.
They are what they are. Now, I may change that at some point, but the object itself stands for the experience. So if I were to try to make it fit a gallery space or a museum scale, it would sort of be not truthful.
Artificial.
It would be artificial. That's a better word. So I don't. I just do them and move on.
Well, we have time for just one more question. And I have to ask about some of the most recent self-portraits in which it looks like you have deconstructed the self-portrait.
Yes.
You know, we talked about how the backdrops are sort of overtaking the subject. In some of the most recent self-portraits, the portrait is implied at the perhaps the least in which I see looks like a vertebra and a rib cage where the backdrop is completely overtaken the form. Is this sort of an exploration of this form you've been doing for so long?
Yes, I to mentioned my father. He was somebody that I grew up, he was a construction worker, and we traveled quite a bit in the countryside when he was building roads. He taught me a lot about walking in the woods and that experience of being in wilderness. Those experiences are experiences I still try to get to. I'm a city girl now. I live in New York and Chicago. But this experience of the wilderness, where one sees in this environment, especially at twilight, life that you can't quite pin down. What's going on? Who's there? And there's always a who. So that awareness came to me a little while ago. And I wanted, especially in this group of works, which is not everything I've been doing, but it's a very particular trajectory, I wanted to go after that idea of the latent discovery of who's there. The paintings are made from laser stencils that then are made from one of my portraits from the mirror that are very figurative and very solid. I take those stencils and overlay them again and again and again till something arises that catches a particular situation of this experience. Mm-hmm. That is, there's somebody there, but how are they there? And how much of them can I see? And what does that mean? Is this a friend, a foe? Is it confusion? These internal states. I'll say something very brief, and that is there's no proof that any of us has that another has feelings or dreams. And art maybe is an example or evidence that that could be there. This group of portraits is about that, their testimony to the portrayal from me that that is cognizant, that's happening inside the head. And so all of those, every move in those paintings is made from a piece of my head.
Yeah.
So I'm a picture of my head, and I'm reconstructing something from eyes, nose, mouth, so and so forth. They look like landscapes, but it's just an eye, a piece of an earlobe, and so on and so forth. A rib cage is a nose that's repeated. So that's what that is.
Well, you can see the results at the Alexander Hogue Gallery. Susanna Coffey, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Contemporary figurative painter and artist Susanna Coffey speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. She is the University of Tulsa School of Art's Ruth Mayo Distinguished Visiting Artist. A mini retrospective of her work, Going to Ground, opens at the Alexander Hogue Gallery. It'll be on display tomorrow through December 15th, and there'll be an opening lecture and reception tomorrow, beginning with a lecture at 4 o'clock, a reception at 5 o'clock at the Hogue Gallery in Phillips Hall on the University of Tulsa campus. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.